This week on Free Association, I chat with Felicia Gallegos from Savvy. We chat about sexual assault to answer questions like, what is it? And how can folks support survivors? A student shares her journey with supporting survivors, and I review some articles on how rape myth acceptance influences our perceptions of sexual assault. Just a reminder that today we are talking about sexual assault. Not anything graphic, but if this is a topic or issue that makes you or those around you uncomfortable, it might be a good idea to listen to something else today. Otherwise, I'm Katie Labor, and you're listening to Free Association. Welcome, welcome, listeners. We have another episode of Free Association today, and today we have Felicia Gallegos from Savvy. Welcome, welcome.
Hi, happy to be here.
Great to have you. So just to talk a little bit about your background, you've been working at Savvy for 2 years, mm-hmm. and you started in the advocate role, and a lot of that has to do with helping clients and survivors adjust like their classroom schedule or their work schedule. And then more recently, you started doing work as the outreach and advocacy specialist. Mm-hmm. And on top of all of that, you're also working on your master's in social work.
Correct. Yep.
Oh my goodness. So you do all of the things.
Yes.
And chief among them is helping folks understand sexual assault and rape and a lot of the assumptions that tend to get in the way of supporting survivors.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking all about that. And I just want to start with a very basic question that I think is very easily misunderstood, which is, what is sexual assault and rape?
Yeah, so I actually really appreciate you asking that question because mm-hmm. a lot of people feel like they kind of know what it is, but yep. there's a lot of misconceptions out there about
Absolutely.
What's going on. So I actually kind of wanted to break it down a little bit more and talk about sexual harassment first, which is going to be any unwanted advances, so catcalling mm-hmm. type of things, inappropriate language mm-hmm. that's unwanted. Then we get into more kind of like the physical realm of things with mm-hmm. sexual assault. And here at the university, there's actually two breakdowns of sexual assault that I find easiest to help understand mm-hmm. it. The first one is sexual assault contact, okay. which means such activities as fondling, mm-hmm. Kissing, any unwanted contact of that sort. Mm-hmm. And then sexual assault. The second one is sexual assault penetration. So mm-hmm. this is, as you can see in the name, any form of penetration that's unwanted in any area on an individual. So
okay.
And again, the key word being non-consensual, unwanted behavior. And to break it down even more specifically into rape, that's generally the sexual assault penetration, mm-hmm. More violent we see in rapes.
Yeah. So with all those definitions, I could see how folks could maybe develop some misconceptions about sexual assault and rape. What are the right. most common ones that you tend to come across in your programming or interactions with students?
Right. So I think one of the most common misconceptions that we see is mm-hmm. kind of the stereotype of a perpetrator. So, yep. yeah. So everybody pictures this stranger in the bushes mm-hmm. or in a dark alley.
Ski mask.
Exactly. Somebody you don't know. It's really a scary situation, jumping mm-hmm. out of the bushes type thing. And that's not generally the case. Mm-hmm. So even on our campus specifically, we did a campus climate survey last spring. Mm-hmm. And we found that 90% of those that had experienced sexual violence had experienced it from somebody they knew, an acquaintance
yeah.
specifically. And so I think that just that misconception alone deters people from seeking help so much too, because it's hard to identify mm-hmm. what happened to you when it was your best friend or
yeah.
your spouse or, you mm-hmm. know, somebody that you know cares about you, but it just became a complicated situation and
yeah.
it makes it hard to identify what's going on. I think another misconception is that sexual assaults are rare. So
yep.
there's this idea that, especially here in our community, like, yes, we are a very safe community, and mm-hmm. but there is this huge misconception that, well, it doesn't happen here, and it definitely won't happen to me. Mm-hmm. And honestly, taking into account the acquaintance, it just, maybe we don't have people jumping out of bushes as frequently as we do acquaintances, but it's still happening.
Right.
So and that's another huge...
I can imagine being in that mindset too, that it's only people that are jumping out of bushes in dark corners and that it doesn't happen makes it really hard to either support a survivor or to process it yourself.
Yeah. It's just, you know, there's two barriers. First, identifying what happened, and then again, processing through that. And so another misconception that I want to point out is that men can't be raped unless they identify as gay.
Yep. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yes. That's just really unfortunate, because there's a lot of men who identify as something different and have experienced assault. And it makes it so hard for them to be able to identify, because this shouldn't be happening to me. That's not the stereotypical way of a guy being assaulted. But really, it can it happens in all relationships.
Right. And some of that sounds like it's very much rooted in some of those sexual stereotypes that we have, that men are these beings who always want sex. And that means that, you know, they're not allowed by virtue of their sexuality to have something that's non-consensual. And that's simply not true.
Right.
And really harmful that we have both these stereotypes of men and women that really impact our perceptions of sexual assault and rape. Yeah. And I'm curious what's your take about where these like stereotypes come from.
Yeah, so a lot of things. Where do any stereotypes come from? But stereotypes come from, specifically in this, you know, cultures, the cultures that we're living in, what we choose to discuss and how we choose to classify men and women and the roles they play in society, which also makes it hard here on a college campus with identifying, because you have so many different cultures.
Oh my goodness, yes.
That are identifying different things, different experiences as different ways. So,
yeah. Do you get the sense that kind of the way that we talk about sexuality, I get the sense that talking about sex is still considered very taboo. And I'm curious how you think that maybe influences or intersects with some of these misconceptions, or even how we talk about sexual assault and rape.
Right. No, it 100% impacts the way people view sexual assault. If you're not having a conversation about sex, I can guarantee you're not having a conversation about sexual assault and debunking kind of these misconceptions. You're not having those conversations. And so you're not able to identify what's going on other than what's in media. So, and if you look at media, unfortunately, there is a lot of portrayal of women as being very sexual and men being very masculine. And then also just, you know, sexual, like misconceptions of sexual assault are in media, where it is the stranger jumping out of the bushes. And so if that's your only way of being educated on this information, we're missing the mark.
Yeah, so it seems like if, as a society, we were more open to those conversations, that it would be easier to maybe understand and find empathy and understanding and not have these stereotypes get in the way. But let's take a quick break and talk a little bit about more about what are some of the barriers that get in the way for those who have experienced sexual assault.
Okay.
This is For Science, a segment where I review a study in psychological science. This episode, I'm reviewing a study on sexual assault and rape myth acceptance. So this episode on For Science, I'm going to talk about an article on heterosexual sexual assault from 2004 by Frise, Moya, and Megias. As usual, you can find a link to the study in our show page. And these authors examined how rape myth acceptance influenced things like perceptions of victim responsibility and likelihood of reporting. And for those of you that don't know, rape myth acceptance are a series of beliefs or myths that contribute to victim blaming. So an example is believing that if a woman is wearing a short skirt, that she's asking to be sexually assaulted or raped. And it's most typically applied to heterosexual sexual assault scenarios. So the authors did a 3x3 experimental design, and participants were asked to read one of three stories. They were randomly assigned to read a stranger rape, so that stereotype of a man jumping out of a bush, out of the bushes and sexually assaulting a woman, marital rape, so a heterosexual couple scenario in which the husband forces intercourse with his wife, and a date rape scenario where a woman is intoxicated and wearing a short skirt and leaves a party with a man that forces her to have intercourse. What's really interesting about this study is that participants that agreed with a larger amount of rape myths tended to perceive the victim as more responsible and were less likely to encourage the victim to report compared to those who were lower in rape myth acceptance. And this is particularly true when we look at how some of those conditions with different types of rape and rape myth acceptance intersect. This was particularly true for the date rape scenario, meaning that when folks tended to, for folks that read the date rape scenario and were high in rape myth acceptance, really tended to see the victim as exceptionally responsible compared to the other conditions, and were probably the least likely to recommend that she reported. I always like to remind people that I'm only reviewing one study in these segments, but it does suggest a potential area for growth if you want to work on being an advocate or ally or supporter of those who have survived sexual assault. The first is to familiarize yourself with these rape myths, and you're already doing a great job by listening to this podcast. And the second is when you hear a rape myth in yourself, whether or not that's a thought or whether or not that's a comment made by you or someone else, call it out. You know, it's those things, according to this study, that tend to contribute to not believing women or not encouraging them to get the support or justice that they need. For those of you that are listening to this podcast on the radio on 92.3, just a reminder that we're talking about sexual assault. And if this is something that makes you uncomfortable, I encourage you to use your own judgment on whether or not this is a good thing for you to listen to right now. So I want to talk more about what it's like after experiencing a sexual assault for a survivor. And, you know, when I think of that, I think about barriers. Like, what are the things that get in the way of getting support? And I'm curious, what are the most common barriers you see for reporting for survivors?
Right. Actually, I love that you're bringing this up, because I think once we're able to discuss what barriers are, people can identify those in their life. Mm-hmm. You know, that's deterring them from seeking help. And so the first one I want to talk about, we touched a little bit in the first segment, was just they didn't know what happened. They don't know what happened to them. So when someone is assaulted, the most common response, we hear flight or fight, right? Flight or fight response. But the most common response in survivors is freeze. Yes. So their brain and body freezes over. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's a completely a protection of the body. The body is putting that measure in to protect itself, but it makes it very hard for processing following the assault. And so how are you to know if you need to seek help if you don't even really know what just happened?
Right. And that totally goes back to some of those stereotypes of even that we have of like consent, like this idea that I didn't say yes and I didn't say no. Mm-hmm. So I guess that means I consented.
Right. And, you know, consent is such a tricky line, but it basically is if you don't have a yes, consent is not given. But that doesn't mean that the situation is clear by any means.
Yeah. So what are some of the other barriers that you see to reporting?
So the next barrier we see kind of have to deal again. So, let me point out, let me back up a little bit. Let me point out. So going to Savvy or CAPS, those are confidential resources here on campus. And you can come and talk to us without a report going forward, without names going anywhere. And so I bring that up because it's going to address kind of the next two barriers that I see. And the first one being didn't want their perpetrator to get in trouble. Because again, if we're looking, as we talked about in the first segment, 90% acquaintance, you likely know who your perpetrator was.
And so, or even the retribution.
Right, exactly. And so you don't want them to get in trouble. Also, mm-hmm. if you're still struggling with identifying exactly what happened, you don't want somebody to get in trouble for something you don't know.
Right.
For
or sure don't what happened. Feel like you understand yet.
Right, right. And then the second one, kind of in this category, is they didn't want anyone to find out.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important to know that there are resources on this campus, Savvy and CAPS, that you mm-hmm. can come to completely confidentially and kind of work through and process what happened before you ever have to make a decision about what you want to do, if you want anybody yeah. to know, if you want to report. So those barriers should be taken away from by knowing that.
Right. So it sounds like something that's important is being able to find those confidential resources at CAPS. And then, you know, what I'm thinking about as we're talking about this is this piece of sometimes it feels like the longer you wait, society is going to be like, well, why didn't you report it mm-hmm. like immediately, which is really grinds my gears.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's another barrier that I was going to mention is kind of this, you know, we talked about earlier the stereotype that people mm-hmm. put on perpetrators, but there's a stereotype placed on survivors and kind yeah. of this expectation placed on survivors. And coming forward and saying that you are a survivor almost automatically puts that lens on you. Mm-hmm. So people see you as, you know, oh, well, why didn't you? They get the questions like, why didn't you report? You know,
and this right.
kind of goes into victim blaming, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But why didn't you report? You should have reported sooner. And also, are you okay? And, you yeah. know, not every survivor is going to be falling apart. I mean, mm-hmm. many do, and that's completely fine and a normal response. But there's just this stereotype also placed on survivors that, you know, once you come forward and seek help,
right,
you step into that mold. Do you want to do that or not? It's yeah. hard to know.
Even that assumption can feel threatening that other people might have as another barrier to reporting.
Right.
So what do you think are kind of the cultural pieces that maybe prevent folks from going to like Savvy or CAPS to get those resources that could be really helpful to clarify even what happened?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, you have to look at the way different cultures define gender-based violence.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely,
many don't even have a definition for domestic violence
yeah.
or dating violence. They're just isn't. For some, it's kind of the norm for mm-hmm. men to be superior in the family or
yep.
certain things like that. And it's not to say there's anything wrong with that, but when somebody of that type of that culture experiences violence,
yeah,
they may not be able to recognize it at all because it's kind of normal.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about a paper that I wrote about violence against women in Pakistan mm-hmm. recently.
Oh, yes.
And the violence against women is so extreme and their family structures are so like masculine based that things like acid throwing are considered like violence against mm-hmm. women. And within our culture,
wow.
like that would be so extreme that to
exactly.
identify the often very subtle forms of violence against mm-hmm. women would be really difficult from that cultural yeah. perspective.
Yeah. And then not only with identifying, but again, seeking help. You know, there's
yeah.
different attitudes towards seeking help in different cultures. And
mm-hmm.
some, honestly, in the American culture altogether, it's kind of buckle down and get it done mm-hmm. and you do things on your own and take care of it. And that's just not the best outlook when it comes to help seeking, because you're not going to seek help if you have this mindset of, I can do this on my own.
Yeah, you know? The pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Yeah,
yep, exactly.
Oh, so oftentimes when folks are going through that process of trying to determine like what's happening for them, which mm-hmm. is we see a lot in counseling, but
yes.
what are the things that family or friends say that are really well-meaning, but at the end of the day are not helpful?
Yeah, and I think this comes a little bit into any comments that are going to stereotype the survivor. So saying,
yeah. What were you wearing?
Right. What were you wearing?
How much had you drank?
Yeah. How, and you know, these are exactly victim blaming statements, but it's just these questions that are, I don't know, trying to help identify the family and friends are trying to help the survivor identify why this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you yeah. know, everybody wants to know that because it helps with healing. Like,
right.
why did this happen? Once you mm-hmm. can understand that, it's kind of, okay, this is what I'm going to do about it. But with sexual violence, it isn't like any other crime where you just, right. oh, well, you should have locked your doors or...
Right. Why didn't you have pepper spray on you?
Exactly. Exactly. It doesn't work that way. But we're mm-hmm. just so naturally inclined to ask those questions. It's human nature. And mm-hmm. so these questions are being asked that aren't really helpful because right. at the end of the day, survivor had nothing to do with the experience.
Right.
It was the perpetrator's choice.
And doesn't that really link with that thing that we were talking about earlier, how people assume that because it's a stranger jumping out of a bush, that it's almost like when you hear someone disclose, psychologically you're thinking, well, I know this is not a very common thing, so right. naturally I'm going to ask all these questions to help you as a survivor figure out whether or not it was actually that.
Yeah. It's almost like trying to figure out that it's not that's not what
right.
happened.
And who is that for? Is that for that's for you as the person who's being disclosed to?
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually want to bring up, I read this article the other day about victim blaming actually being kind of a defense mm-hmm. mechanism. So
yeah.
people are asking these questions, well, what were you wearing? Where were you at? What did you do to entice mm-hmm. that behavior? So that they can figure out in their mind, okay, well, whatever they did, I'm not going to do that. Because
yeah.
I'm going to distance myself from that situation as much as I can. And so they're defending themselves.
Yeah.
And
what do I need to do to make sure that this thing isn't going to happen to me?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you know, what generally is victim blaming?
So victim blaming is just any type of statement, media portrayal that is placing the responsibility of the crime on the victim. Hmm. And most of the time, these are not done, consciously.
Intentionally.
Intentionally,
yeah.
Yes, that's the better word.
Yeah.
They're done, you know, to, again, try to find the why and get to the bottom of it and help work through the mm-hmm. situation. So what were you wearing or those types of questions
yeah.
are done.
Well, I want us to take another break here, and I think the next thing we're going to talk about is really important, this piece of how do you support survivors?
Yeah.
Hearing from USU is a segment where students share their experiences. This episode, a student shares how they got interested in supporting sexual assault survivors.
So I had never had any kind of experiences with sexual assault survivors or anything like that. But in high school, one of my friends disclosed to me that she had faced years of sexual abuse, and this was kind of unbeknownst to me. I had no idea that this had happened, and I'd been friends with her for a long time, so this had been happening while I was friends with her, and I just had no idea. So once that had happened, I just kind of was like thrown through a loop. I had no idea where to have her turn or what to suggest for her, and so I kind of tried to help her on my own with that, which was just not the right approach. She needed actual help, not just support from a friend. And so once I looked into services for her, I found out about CAPSA here in the Valley. And so I talked to her a little bit about that, and I talked to a counselor, and I had her talk to a police officer, and we kind of got on the right track with that. And then from that experience, I started volunteering at CAPSA, and I started working back in the shelter there and interacting with sexual assault survivors, kind of hearing their stories, getting more involved in that kind of work. And I ended up joining the mobile crisis team there, which is like a 24-hour rape advocacy group of people. So if there's a rape and the ER wants somebody to come support the victim, they'll call an advocate from CAPSA, and then you go to the ER and you take write all the stuff in the case file and get everything squared away that way. And that was probably the most interesting and I feel like rewarding work that I've ever been involved in. And I've seen so many, I feel like it's allowed me to see so much resiliency among sexual assault survivors. And then from that experience from being at CAPSA, when I heard about this peer educator position at Savvy, that's when I became really interested in this, because it's kind of a different approach from what I was doing. I was kind of like, assisting people once it had already happened, and I feel like Savvy's work is more prevention education based, and so it's like trying to stop it before anything happens. So I really liked that.
Just a reminder for those of you that are tuning in on Aggie Radio 92.3, we do talk about sexual assault in this episode of Free Association. If that makes you uncomfortable, please use your judgment on whether or not this is good for you to listen to at this time. So for this last part, I want us to shift to talking about like what people can do, how people can support survivors. So I'm kind of curious, like what are the questions that people should be doing or the questions they should be asking to get past some of these rape myths or stereotypes that we've been talking about?
Well, I think of all, I think first of all, you have to be in touch with how you view both victims and perpetrators, survivors and perpetrators. We have classifications and stereotypes in our head for both.
Yeah.
And so absolutely. Because of that, we kind of picture them in a certain light. When in reality, every survivor is different, every perpetrator is different, every situation is different. And so it's really important that you first get in touch with how you view these stereotypes and then challenge them, challenge yourself. And in addition to that, challenge those around you. When you hear people talking stereotypically about survivors or even perpetrators, challenge those challenge those statements with questions of, you know, why do you view them that way? I think is the question where you have to start with the questions.
Yeah. So a couple things. One, it sounds like being aware of when that happens, when a stereotype might be rearing its way into a conversation.
Right.
And then it also sounds like asking yourself, well, why do I believe this? Where is this coming from? Is this consistent with how I want to be for this person in my life, this survivor?
Right. And I think it's been interesting for me, too, because I never really recognized the stereotype we have of survivors. You know, we kind of picture somebody who is at the lowest of their lows, is beaten down. And although that is often true, a lot of survivors are stronger and have worked through their experience and are way stronger because of it. And so it's really important that we don't automatically place those stereotypes on survivors and see them as, you know, fragile. You just have to be open to, you know, they may behave anyway.
Right. And a lot of those stereotypes, my understanding is oftentimes it's women as sexual gatekeepers. For female survivors, at least, that somehow women are put in this position where they have to, like, defend their, I don't know, virginity or sexuality. And that kind of reinforces some of those beliefs regarding seeing women as responsible for experiencing a sexual assault when it is a female survivor.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So how can family members and friends support survivors? What are the things that you find that survivors need?
Well, this is the core of Start By Believing, right? This idea that when someone comes to you and discloses an experience to you, it's not your role to place judgment, to figure out what happened. It's your role in that moment to be with that person, to recognize that no matter what the details are of what happened, they're going through something that's really hard for them right now, and they need help. And so it's really your role to just be present with them in that moment. Listen to their concerns. You know, at this moment, it's not really what you say. It's how you say it, how you're there with them in the moment and how you act. And I think also, you know, it's that's the whole movement of Start By Believing. The second part of it is knowing the resources that are around. You need to know, because your role is not a therapist. Even if you are a therapist, your role in this moment may not be to do therapy. It is simply to just listen and refer.
You know, the thing that sounds powerful to me about that is that, I mean, it's just what people already do for each other.
Right.
Like, everyone is capable of doing those things. It's just a matter of recognizing that as a society, we treat sexual assault so much differently that somehow our human ability to support each other gets thrown to the wayside.
Yeah. It's almost, we make it much more complicated than it really is.
Right.
It's simply, we're worried about what to say, if we say the wrong thing. And, you know, all those are valid concerns in a way, but really your impact, nobody will ever remember exactly what you said. You know, they're in a very confusing place. They don't remember exact details of what you're going to say, but they're going to remember you being there for them and yeah. listening and just accepting them.
Right. And so often when I do therapy, one of the things I hear is that, you know, I'll ask, like, so how are people around you supporting you? And oftentimes the people that matter aren't the people that found the right, the perfect thing to say.
Yeah.
It's more the people that are like, so I don't really know what you need, but I'm here if you need me.
Yeah, exactly. It's so much more of a way of being than it is the right thing to say.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, that just sounds like such a powerful thing. I'm wondering how USU students can get involved.
With Start By Believing?
Yeah.
So there is going to be Start By Believing is April 4th, the National okay. Start By Believing Day.
Cool.
Actually, Utah declared that the day. They were nice. One of the first states to declare a Start By Believing Day, which is awesome.
Heck yes.
But the university is jumping on board with the state, partnering with CAPSA in the community.
Mm-hmm.
We will be hosting booths across okay. campus, the library and the TSC, where you can come pledge to Start By Believing. And, you know, these pledge booths are more than just signing your name on a piece of paper.
Right.
There's going to be students there who have been educated about Start By Believing, you know, mm-hmm. savvy peer educators, other students who have been trained.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to talk to you and have these conversations about what it really means to start by believing, so that
mm-hmm.
when you do pledge to start by believing, you know, you're equipped with
yeah.
with the tools to be able to do so successfully. And, you know, the whole point is to show that this community is such a community of support.
Mm-hmm.
And students want to help. There is that underlying Aggie family that you just can't deny.
Yeah.
And I think this movement really just hones in on that unity that we have across campus mm-hmm. and shows as people walk by these booths and they see, you know, people be able to take their picture and place it up on the board, and people can see all these yeah. people that they can turn to be heard.
So it's so important that students really be a part of this, if they're willing to. Obviously, you don't want people to just sign a piece of paper
right.
for the sake of signing it, but I just imagine the power of seeing how many people are willing to stand up and, you know, start by believing for victims. So
right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So is there anything else, you know, before we wrap up that you'd like to add?
The one thing I just want to touch on, and we've kind of touched on it, but the reason why Start By Believing is so important is not only so survivors are getting the support that they need, but it's been shown that the first reaction
mm-hmm.
somebody gets when they disclose
yep.
dictates their entire help-seeking behavior after
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if they come to you and are questioned about their experience, judged, mm-hmm. they're less likely to turn anywhere else for help.
Yeah.
And so this first stop is so important, that when someone confides in you, you keep in mind you may be the first person they've ever told.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, be there with them.
Yeah. So being aware of, you know, the power that first disclosure can have, and yeah. really supporting.
Yeah. Don't let that, it shouldn't scare you. It's a yeah. good thing.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Yes, of course.
Free Association is a collaborative podcast made with Aggie Radio, Alternative Radio for an Alternative Audience, and USU's Counseling Center, CAPS. I would like to give a special thanks to Felicia for coming in and sharing her knowledge, as well as the student that shared their experience with supporting sexual assault survivors, and you for listening today. If you're interested in getting involved in the Start By Believing campaign, there will be an opportunity to pledge on April 4th, which is a Wednesday, from 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. There will be pledge booths in the library foyer and by the TSC. Please note that everything expressed in this podcast is the opinion and view of the listener and not anything official within the university. There are resources within the show page if if this was something triggering or you would like to just learn more. Thank you again for listening to another episode of Free Association. I'm Katie Labor.